Hey, all you Queer Queries listeners, thank you so much for tuning into this episode of the show. I'm so honored to speak with our guest today. I have with me a Black, queer, genderqueer facilitator, consultant, and healing justice practitioner who is also a licensed clinical social worker committed to working at the intersections of movements for racial, gender, economic, trans, and queer justice and liberation. He is also the founder and executive director for the National Queer and Trans Therapists of Color Network, which is a healing justice organization committed to transforming mental health for queer and trans people of color. Please welcome to your ears, Erica Woodland. Hello, Erica.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Of course. How are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm caffeinated. I'm ready for the week.
Always good, especially in the morning. I'm not a coffee or caffeinate person, but I do have my tea, which suffices for me, even if there's no caffeine in it. But yeah, cool. So let's get started. So first question that I ask everyone is, what was your first introduction to queerness, LGBTQ plus community?
That is a great question. I was actually talking about that over the weekend with some friends. We were sharing our coming out stories and all of the calamities that go along with it. You know, as somebody who just knew I was queer since I was 8 or 9 years old, I knew that my exploration of that queerness required me to be out of my mother's home. And so I would say going to college was really my first opportunity building community with other LGBTQ folks and, you know, in an environment where we were questioning everything, right? And critiquing everything and really thinking about the world in ways that were often just in reaction to some of the limitations that we experienced as younger people, adolescents.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have like any examples, like whether it be in media or like people in your immediate circle growing up that you first saw and you were like, maybe like, what is that?
You know, my mom had a really dear friend who I found out later was a Black queer man, right? But, you know, before you have language for some of these things, you just have this like real inner sense of knowing. And so when I think about him and I think about how important he was in terms of supporting my mom and the care he provided to us and the nurturing that he provided to us, it didn't necessarily make sense as a young person. But then when I started coming out, I was like, oh, all the dots started to connect. And what I'll say is that in college, part of what was really cool at that time is that there was a group for queer people of color on campus. And so we had community, right? We had the ability to connect with each other. And we had, you know, we were in an academic context where we were engaging with like Marlon Riggs and Essex Hemphill and Audre Lorde. And so I think being in that environment was really powerful. Because not only was I not alone navigating these things, but we were also just diving into all these texts and thinking by primarily Black queer folks who were really articulating our experience, but decades earlier, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's super, super cool. Because I think that, at least in my experience and in conversations I've had, I think that is so rare. The fact that you found that community and also like delved into the text and the thoughts, and it wasn't just like you were just having these conversations, but you were actually like getting to learn history and getting to learn like how other people have lived before you and their thoughts and feelings. Because I know for me, that was definitely the turning point in my queer evolution, was when I first had conversations about like queer life with other queer people and then just started learning about our history. And now I'm very much like a history nut. Like, I really don't like watching or reading anything that isn't queer to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And learning especially. And I always say like, not everyone has to be like a historian, but it's important that you know our history, especially because it's not taught. It is in these very like, in these groups.
Right.
And like, I know at least like my alma mater, a lot of schools don't have like classes that are queer theory based or anything like that. So it's something you have to do. You have to go out of your way and do your own work for. So yeah, all that to say, that's just like super, super cool that you had that.
It was really cool also because, you know, my consciousness was shifting and expanding so rapidly. And so my political awakening, my spiritual awakening, those things happened alongside queerness. And it was really amazing because I'm not someone for whom this is just like an identity that is, you know, just deeply personal. It is politicized and it lives in a historical context. And I see myself as part of a legacy. And so I really appreciate the naming of history and really both honoring, right, the folks who came before us, but also understanding kind of our role in this broader movement.
Mm-hmm. It's funny that you just said understanding yourself in a political sense, because one of the most recent interviews I had, we were talking about, it was specifically like queerness in the music industry. And we're talking about like Lil Nas X and how in this day and age, queer people just being themselves and doing things that is like normal for us in our community is political.
Mm-hmm.
Like just the act of us being ourselves is political. And I think that's, it's just so interesting because I think there's so many of us that are equipped to handle that like backlash and people that, especially in the public eye or questioning or our scrutinization. But there's a lot of people who are just like, I'm just trying to make art or I'm just trying to do this or help people. And like, why is the fact that I am creating this exclusively queer space or making this like having a queer love story in this music video, like why is that a political thing?
One of the conversations I was having over the weekend with some friends is even if you don't want to have your identity politicized, like you actually can't help it, you know, literally by me just walking through the world, being in a room, I elicit so much discomfort from people, right? Whether it's like really specifically about queer and transphobia or, you know, I found a lot of people were just very activated around the boldness that I move through the world with, you know, and that I choose to move towards liberation and I'm willing to accept some of the consequences of that, right? And not that everybody needs to do that, right? I am able to do that because I came out a particular time where there was all of our queer ancestors and transcestors laid the groundwork for me to be out in a particular way. And so that is not something that I take for granted. But I want us to be in a world where if being queer is like super politicized for you, that's cool. And if it's not, it's not, right? But so much is projected onto our bodies.
It's this interesting thing because I do this, but I'm primarily a performer. But something that has come up a lot within conversations is people, when we're talking about the increased need for representation in media and the increased need for stories that don't just focus on our trauma, not saying like those stories aren't important, but this important need to normalize like all aspects of our life, just queer people in happy relationships, having happy endings, and how there's a lot of people that are like thinking that we wake up and think like, oh, I'm a gay human or I'm a trans human or I'm a non-binary human and this is my life. And I always say like, yes, that is an aspect about me, but it is not the full facet of who I am, but it informs how I live my life and what I choose to do with my life, because I'm someone who is very much like everything I do, I try to center queer people, whether it's learning, whether it's creative projects or something, because I want to see all of our community represented and having seats at the table and being able to tell their own stories and not just like one person is kind of holding the reins for everything that we are getting exposure to and everything that cis, white, straight audiences are getting exposure to about our community. Yeah. What was like a defining moment that you specifically decided to go into the field of mental health?
That is a great story. So as a little one, I was pretty committed to being a doctor. I was like, medicine it is. I am all about science. I'm really good at science. And in my family, community, educational context, it was kind of like, you're smart and you're Black, so you can be a doctor or a lawyer. There weren't a lot of other options presented to me. It just so happened, though, that I was really into science. And so when I went to college, I did pre-med. And through that process and that training, but also simultaneously this expansion in terms of my political consciousness, I became pretty disillusioned with science and just the very explicit ways that racism was just baked into everything. I remember being in a class and we were talking about the origin of HIV/AIDS, and they had this very racist theory that they were promoting in 2001 at an Ivy League institution. I was like, I'm so confused. Like, how did we get here? And so in lieu of taking my last requirement of my pre-med adventure in organic chemistry, I chose to take a course on the Black Panther Party. And that actually really accelerated some of the questions that I was sitting in around what is the best use of the skills that I have and the things that I want to do. And this desire to be of service has always been a theme in my life. And it's not like psychology or social work are much better, but as someone who's deeply curious about human behavior and really wants to understand why people do what they do, how people navigate things that are incomprehensible, I chose to study psychology with the awareness that that system is also very much rooted in white supremacy, ableism, queer and transphobia, et cetera. So that journey brought me back home, right? I left college and I didn't necessarily know what I wanted to do. But I did know that a lot of the privileges that I had were not because I'm special, but because as somebody who grew up in a working class community in a single parent household and who got to see I had different outcomes than my peers, right? And a lot of that had to do with education, right? And opportunities. So there's a way that moving towards social work specifically was an intervention around tokenization, right? It was really an intervention around what is my duty to give back because of the folks who poured into me? And also, what is my duty to give back because the system is set up for Black folks in particular to have certain outcomes? And so I started doing work in harm reduction and HIV/AIDS, and I was organizing around prison abolition. And I was doing all these things where I was like directly confronting intergenerational trauma and historical trauma. And I felt like it was really irresponsible as a 20-something-year-old to be facilitating support groups in the jail with no training, right? And a lot of people don't have the option to choose to go into more debt, to go to school, to get that training. But I felt it was important to get that training specifically around how do I hold space for survivors, and also to do some thinking about how to broaden out my skill set, right? So I was getting trained up as an organizer. I was getting trained up as a harm reduction worker. And I've always done work kind of at the intersections of organizing and direct care. And so social work was the least harmful kind of on-ramp for me around mental health. And, you know, it's full of its problems. But at that time, it was the only space where people were explicitly engaging with social justice as a framework. And so that felt really important to me. I think the other layer of that story is my own experiences navigating depression and anxiety and trauma. You know, having experienced really, really intense depression in college and having a group of friends be like, look, you need to go see a therapist. And I'm like, I don't need therapy. And my first therapist was awesome. She was a Afro-Puerto Rican counselor. She was in the counseling center and she was from New York, and she just like kept it 100. She was like, look, this is what's going on. We have 5 sessions. I'm trying to save your life out here in these streets and I need you. She was trying to activate something inside of me to fight, right, for my life at that time, spiritually and emotionally. And because she was so legible to me, because she didn't do a lot of coddling, because we spoke in a similar way, she really saw that I was suffering and she really validated that suffering. And she also understood the context in which that suffering was happening, that I probably would not have gotten good care if it hadn't been for someone like her. And so that started my healing journey in terms of engaging the mental health system. And if it weren't for that, I would probably not be doing what I'm doing today, only because my first experience was actually a positive one. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the experiences after that, not so much.
That's truly an incredible story. There's so many things that you touched on that I wanted to highlight when you were talking about like getting to the root. And I believe I read this on your website. And I think this is because I'm a creative. I often use like the phrase like origin story, like with myself, and have been like the therapy of like trying to figure out like what's the origin story of like, why do I do a certain thing? So I just like really relate to your mission of like wanting to like help uncover that root, because I think there's so many little facets of growing up queer and then the multitude of intersections that come with that, whether it's Black, whether it's trans, like all of these different things that add up to sometimes like little things of how you carry yourself in the world. And then to connect that to what you were saying, like I I'm kind of envious of you that you had the positive first therapy experience, because I think, speaking for me, and I know I'm not the only one, like my first experience was with like a Christian counselor at the time when I'm like, I don't want to be gay. And I think like there's a multitude of reasons why I think like specifically like some queer people have like resistance to see a therapist. But I think that's like one aspect, because it's like you can have like having someone that doesn't understand you or speak that same language. And I think that's something I've realized that doesn't just go for a therapist, but like with doctors, with anyone in healthcare and probably outside, but having someone that speaks your language is incredibly important.
Yeah, I think that this piece around just the kinds of harm that mental health practitioners, healthcare providers, healers, the kinds of harm that's possible when people are seeking care, right? Usually by the time you see someone, they're in crisis. We're not at the place yet where most of us are like in a prevention context, like going to get taken care of, especially if you're talking about queer and trans people, Black, Indigenous, and people of color, poor folks, sick and disabled folks. Like a lot of the work that I do now is really helping people understand the historical context of the harm and violence connected to the medical industrial complex. That is not a wholesale rejection of medicine or healthcare or anything, right? Or science, but it really is, how do we go back in time and understand that these systems were built in the context of attempted genocide, enslavement, and exploitation? And what is our responsibility as practitioners, even if we are from particular communities that are directly impacted by that harm? If we don't understand that and we're engaging with folks, I think a real common example that I see is whether it's Black healthcare providers or therapists who are like, just why are people so mistrustful? And I'm like, I would never question someone's mistrust of a therapist, a social worker, a doctor. There are real reasons for that. And my job is not to convince you that I'm trustworthy. My job is to keep showing up and like you get to assess, you know, even the people I work with now in my private practice, I'm like, don't listen to what I'm saying just because I'm saying it. Like the purpose of this work is to bring you back into what you know to be true for yourself. And even if someone, you trust them and things resonate with you, we should not be moving people towards giving their power away to these systems, and definitely not to individual practitioners. And so there is this power dynamic and there is this layer of burden that I think a lot of practitioners in our network are navigating around. Sometimes we represent systems that have tried to take us out, but are also taking out the folks who we're working with. And we might be the face of that system, right? We didn't create it, right? But we have a unique role to intervene. And mental health care in this country, largely inaccessible. And also there's a way that it's deemed as there's only one way to heal. There's only one way to take care of your body. I know that we're in this moment where, you know, there's a lot more conversation around quote unquote alternative ways of healing, although those are not alternative. They're traditional, you know, they're the original ways. And anything that is prescriptive, I have a problem with, because I think people know what they need. And I want our people to have access to any and everything that they need to heal, to take care of themselves, and to move towards liberation.
Mm-hmm. There was something you mentioned, and I feel like I know the answer, but at the beginning when you're talking about this multifaceted aspects of trauma that you're dealing with, generational trauma, particularly when you're pertaining to different communities, I'm curious, is that information that you self-taught, or is that anything that you were taught in your schooling?
So I learned about intergenerational trauma, not in my social work program. I can tell you that really clearly. A lot of my schooling involved unschooling and also looking to other sources of knowledge and also being in community, right? So before I had the language of intergenerational trauma, I had the lived experience of certain patterns being passed down in my family, right? And so part of what I feel really curious about is how do we really reassert people's actual knowing in relationship to research and science, right? And to also understand that we have technologies that we're using to make sense of the world. And so the work of Dr. Maria Yellowhorse Braveheart, who really brought us the understanding of historical trauma, Dr. Joy DeGruy, who also really helped us understand post-traumatic slave syndrome and the particular intergenerational consequences of descendants of enslaved Africans. And so these are works that I came into contact with after school in a community of clinicians, a lot of whom were folks of color and queer, who were thinking about how do we do this work differently. And through getting access to that language and those ways of understanding and knowing, it really just reinforced the things I already knew, like in my bones, right? About my people and where we come from. You don't have to go very far to see the intergenerational consequences of slavery, for instance. It's right there. But we live in a world that gaslights Black people into like, no, no, that's not real. That was in the past. And so again, the field, I often say that science substantiates reality. It's like, why is something not real until we have all this research on it? I'm like, how is my experience not real? And I'm telling you what it is, you know? And part of how I understand my experience is through my lived experience, but also through the stories of the elders in my family, the stories of elders in my community, that there are so many different ways of knowledge transmission, and we actually need all of them, right? And we really need to listen to the folks who are most directly impacted by the things that we're talking about. I mean, that feels really basic to me, but that is still something that is quite controversial in a lot of the work that I do.
I feel like this need to validate people's experience with the right wording to get through to someone else so that they understand, which I can sometimes get because sometimes for whatever reason, like people need that. But sometimes, like you're saying, there might not be, or this person might not have the language to communicate what it is because they haven't been exposed to like the vernacular of it all. And this instance of then the problem is put onto the individual trying to communicate because they don't have the words. And so then they therefore invalidating their own experience because it's like, oh, well, maybe it's nothing because I can't communicate that, as opposed to the other individual who this person's being vulnerable with or is like, is now being centered in some kind of way. The other person not continuously holding that space for them to work out and acknowledging like what you're going through is clearly vulnerable and it's going on in real time. So who am I to negate you in any way just because you can't communicate exactly what it is? Because like you're saying, with queer people, it's so multi-layered and goes back years in a multitude of ways, especially when you're dealing with intersection of identity.
I appreciate what you were just saying also, because I'm really interested in meaning making, right? How are people making meaning of what they're experiencing? And so this is in part why I'm trained in a lot of different things, because sometimes that translation is really helpful as a practitioner if you can do that. And if you can't do that, or even if you can, you should just be deeply listening, right? Like I might, as a trained social worker, make sense of your experience in a particular way, right? And that might not resonate with your experience. And part of the work might actually be to unpack these different meaning-making systems to see what they're offering in terms of healing in this moment. But the lack of access to a shared language, that's by design, because you need to then have this professional class of people who are deemed legitimate to help, and then everybody else doesn't matter. And so in our work, we focus on psychotherapists, right? We feel like our particular intervention is to get the therapists together so that we can train each other up, so that we can decrease isolation, so we can like do our own healing work as healers, so we can collectively intervene around the medical industrial complex and also value our own development, right? Because there's so much tokenization in the field, which is just a setup. In my entire career, for the most part, people have been like, oh, okay, well, you're queer, so you work with the queers. And, you know, because you're queer, we don't need to like invest in your development at all. It's just a given. You're queer, they're queer, done. Like, we don't have to deal with them, right? Without being able to hold like, we're not all the same. We don't all come from the same place. Like, this is very complicated and nuanced. And like, you know, as a practitioner, how am I going to get proper clinical supervision as a queer person working with other queer people, even if my supervisor is not queer and not interested in learning anything? So it's just conversations like that that we don't get to have because we spend so much time isolated in systems and institutions that are also undermining our work. And so we focus on psychotherapists, but our work is for mental health practitioners broadly. And that includes anybody in the queer and trans POC community that is tending to the emotional and spiritual well-being of our people, because most of our mental health care comes outside the system. We've always had ecosystems of care that are essential for our survival, because how many times have we gone somewhere to get care and it was not affordable, or people were like, we don't want to take care of you. We're okay with your demise. And so I came into this work via peer support. So I am a trained psychotherapist, social worker, all the things, right? I'm a clinician. I got the stamp of approval until someone says they want to take it away. But my foundation in this work is peer support. My foundation in this work is, how are we moving towards our collective empowerment and self-determination? And we need everybody, right? There are things that I cannot do as a therapist, but if someone's in a peer support space, they can get a different kind of support. And sometimes that's actually more helpful than therapy. And so we really trouble this idea that like only some of us can do this work. And I see that even in my work as a clinical supervisor. I supervise practitioners that are moving towards getting licensed, and I supervise counselors who are not interested in getting a master's, not interested in getting licensed. And everybody's on the same playing field. You're getting the same training from me. We're having the same conversations. Okay, you didn't go to a master's program, but I'm going to give you the clinical words for what you're doing. Because in my experience, a lot of the folks who are in this work and doing really intense trauma work, they're very advanced clinicians. They just don't have the letters. They don't have the shiny baubles. And so because I see my work as an intervention around that power differential, I'm like, I want you to be able to go into a meeting with a table full of therapists and use their language, even though you didn't go to school. And if you want to go in debt and go to school, then we can talk about that too. But it's really just, the reality is our people are receiving the best care outside of that system. So why are we still saying this is the only legit way to heal?
I love all of that. Thank you for sharing all of that. And you made me think of, there's something I came across on your website that I like was so intrigued by, but you talked about working with astrology in your practice. And I'm curious, just like, if you could speak on that.
Oh yeah. I love astrology. So I've been practicing astrology for about 12 years, and I know it's very popular right now in our community. It's very much like name, pronouns, sun, moon, and rising. And I appreciate that. For me, I always have to just name. When things become more popular, they start to lose some of their nuance and complexity. So for me, it's part of my spiritual practice, and it's one of the primary ways that I make sense of the world. I really appreciate astrology because it is the least stigmatizing way for me to make sense of like who I am and what I came into this world with, right? In terms of my strengths, my gifts, my challenges. And the way that I use it in my work is primarily understanding what's happening in the sky at any particular moment, right? And so like I was born, I have a natal chart, but then the planets are doing their thing, right? In relationship to that. And so I'm really interested in larger cycles. And so it also allows me to bring in my study of history, right? Because a lot of the cycles that we're experiencing now, right? If you're thinking about a particular planet's transit, that has happened before. And we can actually look at the correlation between the last time Jupiter was doing this thing, what was happening in the world? What were some of the themes? I use that explicitly in my work if that's a meaning map that works for people, but I often use it implicitly in my practice to just understand the astrological weather, right? To just understand like, oh, here's some of the themes that are going to come up. But even without astrology, I do a lot of different kinds of work in a lot of different contexts. And I'm like, huh, interesting. You know, there's this theme around shame and self-worth that came up in every aspect of my work this week, right? And usually there's some kind of correlation in the stars. So I'm here for astrology. I'm here for all the different ways that we get to think bigger about our human experience, right? I was actually spending time with my elders last night. We were sitting on their porch watching the glorious full moon. You know, I'm talking to one of my elders is in his late 70s, the other's in her 50s. Like, just what does it mean for us to like be in right connection with our environment, with the things that are happening around us? But I do worry that we're in this moment where astrology is getting so popular, it's becoming like a parlor trick. And that's hard for me because I'm like, this is literally part of my spiritual practice. Like, this isn't a personality test. This isn't a game. Like, yeah, it can be fun and I'm here for the fun. But I also think that as a practitioner who's out about being into astrology, which right now astrology is not criminalized, but it could easily go back to being criminalized, right? Like, it's not seen as a legit thing in a lot of circles. So I also know that it is pushing the envelope when any of us are really explicit about some of these other ways that we're working and how we're integrating that with psychotherapy, for instance.
Mm-hmm. I love all that. And I had an excellent conversation with someone last season. We got into like the spirituality of queer people and how like people wouldn't think because of what religious institutions have done to queer people, but queer people are actually some of the most spiritual and in tune when we are given the space to in tune with like our inner selves and like with the world around us. And so when I saw that and hearing you talk, it reminds me of like, we are some of the most in tune people with the world around us because we have to create our own way of making sense of things because the world that we've grown up in is not supporting us. And these institutions that tell us this is the reason behind everything tell us that who we are isn't valid. So us having to look into these different ways and ways of making sense. So I really, really love that that is part of your practice. And I love that that is something you utilize with people. And I definitely hear you on the becoming popular. And I think that's something I think we're seeing in aspects with a lot of queer culture, whether it be language, AAVE, all of these different things that are like getting popular and being appropriated in different ways. And it's just something I'm very interested to see how it develops and just hope that people give this credit where credit is due and actually look behind like where did this actually come from and don't just credit like X celebrity who it's their thing that's trendy right now. Hey y'all, thanks for tuning into this episode of Queer Queries. Now this week, I'm going to talk to you about the National Queer and Trans Therapists of Color Network. Now the National Queer and Trans Therapists of Color Network, or NQTTCN, is a space for queer, gender nonconforming, and trans therapists of color to build, resource, and support one another as clinicians and healers. NQTTCN will provide a network of support for queer and trans people of color, seeking transformative mental health resources rooted in social justice and liberation. This space will support QTPOC to utilize their relationships and collective power to build their capacity for healing in communities. This info was taken from their website, and a link to donate as well as learning more about this organization will be linked in the show notes below. I want to go into how did NQTTCN come about?
Yeah, so I was not trying to start an organization. Let's start there. Because part of the origin story really is that I saw a need in terms of being able to connect queer and trans folks of color to practitioners from our community. I was doing national movement building work. I was working with like just some real fierce, badass folks who were like changing the game. And also because I'm a practitioner, felt comfortable sharing with me like, yeah, like some of the supports I need around my leadership development includes mental health support. And, you know, at the time I was based in the Bay Area and there is a pretty tight-knit community of queer and trans therapists of color. But if folks were, you know, in different parts of the country, whether it be Baltimore, where I grew up, or the Southeast or the Midwest, I was not in connection with those practitioners. So for 5 years, I was like, someone should just start like a national network so we can find each other. It wasn't supposed to be anything more than kind of a way to create a resource that we need and keep it moving, right? I'm very much a social worker like that. I'm like, there's a problem. Let's figure it out. We can work together. You know, at a certain point, my ancestors were like, so that somebody is you. So you need to start this. And in 2016, we launched in May of that year. And I don't know if you want to go back in time, but that the summer of 2016 was treacherous. We launched a month before the shooting at Pulse. That summer, Alton Sterling and Philando Castile were murdered. It was leading up to the election, and there was all kinds of just escalation around white violence and nationalism and the kind of rhetoric that makes all of our communities deeply, deeply unsafe. It was a really scary moment. And so I also think simultaneously, you know, because as queer and trans people, we've just had to figure things out for ourselves. Like we were born with the figure it the fuck out gene in a particular way because the world is not organized around our survival or safety. And so folks were having conversations around trauma and mental health in ways that were really pushing back against some of the stigma that's been put onto us, not only around our mental health, but around our identities and our lived experiences. And so when we launched, people were ready. People were ready to talk about it. People were ready to get help. And very quickly, I was inundated with support and people asking for resources. And I was like, I don't even know what to do. I am not the case manager for the United States. So we need to start a directory. We need to set up some systems. And so the first 2 years, we just did a lot of listening to a community. Like, what do you need, right? So our first project was our mental health practitioner directory. Our second project was the mental health fund, which was literally born out of the crisis after the 2016 election. Really just sitting and talking to other therapists about like, what are you seeing in your practice? The level of crisis was just off the charts. And when we sat down to think about what can we do together, folks were like, you know, people need money to pay for therapy. Like, and if you have insurance, yay, most people's insurance is not covering what they need around their mental health. And so we started our mental health fund. Also during that time, did listening sessions with practitioners across the country, which was really amazing. It was a chance to build relationship and community and to also start to understand the larger ecosystem of queer and trans therapists of color across the country. And so since then, we've really started to think about what is our field building strategy? What are the particular interventions that we want to collectively move forward to both support our people around getting access to the resources they deserve, but also to intervene around the medical industrial complex together, right? To say like, this system is harmful and our people need access to the system. And so we need to deal with both of those problems simultaneously. But the other piece of our work that is really crucial is that our primary love initially came from social justice community and social justice movement building organizations who were really understanding this intersection between criminalization, trauma, and how unattended to trauma is actually undermining our movements, right? When you have communities that are highly traumatized and they're cut off from their healing resources, they're cut off from basic human needs, it is much easier to control and dominate those people. It's not like, oh, we're just healing. Like there's something very revolutionary about asserting a healing justice framework because it says like, if we actually recenter healing inside of our movements for liberation, like the chances that we will be free are more tangible to us. There's a lot of work to do, right? But we sit at a lot of these intersections and we like really relish in the tensions and contradictions of those intersections because on the one hand, we're trying to shift the field of mental health, which is like 40 years behind the mainstream conversation around gender, sexuality, race. I'm like really quite amazed at just where some of the conversations are in our field. But simultaneously, we're working with movement organizations who are like, the folks in our membership, our base, like they need supports. Like how do we connect with practitioners on the ground who understand our work, right? Who are not going to come in and support folks in a way that undermines the organizing we're trying to do, right? We actually need to have politicized practitioners who see their role specifically in movement as healers. So it's been a journey. It's been probably one of the biggest surprises of my life because I'm a planner, I'm a perfectionist. So usually something like this, I would have had a 10-year plan and I would still be working on the plan and not doing this thing. So in that way, I appreciate the ancestors because they set me up. But yeah, our work is really trying to think about how do we organize practitioners and what is our role in movements for liberation? And to actually take our cues from organizers, right? To take our cues from organizations who are like, we know how to build power. And then we're like, okay, cool. We know how to support people around transforming intergenerational trauma collectively.
I love that you said healing is revolutionary, because it's something I think you don't think about. And I think especially like this past year of thinking about how often activists, and specifically Black activists, for this past year have had to put themselves and are keeping themselves at the front lines and reliving this just to get some kind of change in a multitude of fields. I know me as a performer, I've like very much witnessed it in terms of like our, the Actors Union and need for change in the theatrical industry. And that's just a sliver of everything that needs to go on. But like thinking about how you don't think about how these people are reliving trauma often just to get some kind of acknowledgement of like, is anything going to be done? So that's so incredible that that is at the forefront of NQTTCN. Oh gosh, and there's something else. I think it was just like you talking about like the year of 2016, and this is kind of like what I also wanted to get into, but made me think of course, the crisis of this year. And I'm curious as to what changes and how things have been for you and your organization amidst everything that has gone on and still continues to go on this past year.
The past year, year and a half, I mean, because it's the intersection of so many crises that a lot of our communities were like, we knew these things have already been happening, right? They just started to happen to enough of us that now all of us are impacted, right? Not in the same way at all, but we're all having to confront the long-term impacts of climate change, right? And climate catastrophe, and how our relationship as human beings to our natural environment has also led to the proliferation of things like pandemics, the economic instability, the political instability, and just how much our lives got turned upside down due to COVID. So a lot of what I have learned and I'm learning in my work is that, you know, when you come from communities where you have to be highly adaptive, a lot of us adapted well. A lot of us, because our survival requires it, have had to be like, okay, so now I need to figure out a different way to do my work, right? I have to do my work virtually. What does that mean? How does that work? What do I need to think about? A lot of us have also been simultaneously experiencing more stress and crisis and trauma while supporting people who are experiencing more stress and crisis and trauma. And so that has really, like, personally, I'm in a real-time conversation with myself around my needs and my care, because my care routines that I had set up that I could just be like, oh, I do this at this interval, that is not going to get me through the pandemic, right? And so for us and for a lot of the folks that we work with in Healing Justice, we're really understanding this also as a spiritual crisis. And we are really understanding that in this moment of crisis, there's a lot of opportunity to do things different because everything is up in the air, right? When you're kind of moving along in life and the ground is really solid, it makes it really hard to do radical shifts and changes. And some of the potential that's available to us right now is actually really powerful and really beautiful. I've often thought about this time as like all potentialities are available to us in this moment. Like the most liberatory potentialities and the most terrifying. So how do we get really clear about the things that we have to let go of collectively to be inside of the world that we want and to be inside of our wildest dreams? It's not just about these external structures that are put upon us. It's also about how we've internalized those structures. So I think there's been a lot of obviously responding to crisis, but also a deeper level of listening that I found in my work to myself and to like, okay, because everything is a shit show right now and we have a limited capacity and resources, it helps you get really clear about what's important. And because our organization was born during a time of crisis, I was always holding like the urgency and need in our community, we are never going to be able to meet that. So actually the real work is like, how are we learning how to be with that? How are we learning how to be with the fact that we're going to lose a lot of people? Even if we worked 24 hours a day, we are going to lose a lot of people because what we're responding to took generations to create. And how do you hold the urgency of now and also the goal, which is long-term infrastructure, so that when these crises occur, we're set up, we're connected, we have the resources on deck, and we know how to mobilize quickly to get folks what they need. So that's a lot of the conversations that we're in with our healing justice comrades around what does that infrastructure need to look like? Because, you know, for instance, I was talking to a comrade, Kara Page, about this last week, but, you know, we just crossed the 16th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, right? And that was the day that Hurricane Ida hit. And what does it mean to 16 years later be like, okay, some things we have set up, but like, actually, there are a lot of things that we still do not have in place to take care of our people. And the assumption that systems are going to take care of us, you know, a lot of our communities just know that that's a lie. And so I don't feel hopeless about this time. This time is very scary. This time is a warrior time. And as a warrior spirit, I'm like, okay, tap me in, coach. Like, what's up? Let's go, right? But it's also a long haul, right? This is like protracted crisis. And, you know, the astrologers do not say that it's going to be cute in 2022 either, right? And so that's the other reason astrology is helpful, because it does give you a sense of timing. It does let you know, like, is this a marathon or a sprint? And if it's a marathon, you have to actually be judicious about your resources, especially when you're at the beginning or the middle phase.
Yeah, you're making me think of something I've been dealing with in the theatrical, like, Broadway industry. But there's this rush of feeling like things are back, like everything's back. And it's been interesting to see this still acknowledgement of, like, we need to change, but not as much as when there was literally nothing going on. It feels more like, let's try and push these industries and things to go back and create this scarcity mentality of the work is limited. So people are just, and again, just speaking for what I'm viewing, but there's so few work. So everyone's just dying to get into a job that they're not thinking about, like, this show is harming trans people and we still do not have a statement from our union. Like, what tangible solutions are being done to make sure trans, queer, BIPOC artists are protected in these spaces? Like, you're saying there's so much to be done, but you're not saying what you're doing to start the beginning of what needs to be done. So it's just very frustrating when it seemed like everyone was all hands in, seemingly optics-wise, like social media-wise, what you're presenting, oftentimes to probably save face. But now it's like, who's still in the fight? I was having a good conversations with my friend Marla, who founded a social justice organization, Claim Our Space Now, during the pandemic. And they created like a similar directory with all different resources. And she's been doing, God, so much. But just talking about how it's like, this last year, summer of activism has definitely dwindled. It's like, how are people going to continue to show up for Black lives? And yeah, so all this to say, just like, I hear you on everything you just said. I don't know if you have anything, any other thoughts.
Yeah, I think this time is really scary. And, you know, when the pandemic first hit, I remember having conversations where some folks I'm close to were like, because we were seeing all of the practice of interdependence, right? Like, all of a sudden it was like mutual aid. And it's like, you know, sick and disabled people have been talking about this stuff forever. And now we all want to get on board, right? But I remember a comrade of mine being like, yeah, this isn't going to last because the speed of capitalism is the speed of capitalism. And at the end of the day, we are rushing back to a normal that actually was very comfortable with leaving a large group of us behind, right? And exploiting a large group of us. And so I think what's been really heartbreaking for me is to see we've all been changed in ways we can't even imagine by this pandemic, just period, right? And so I'm like, yes, this is stressful. Everybody's mental health is taking a hit. Like, people's sense of security, everything is so uncertain. And so in response to that, we want to cling to some sense of certainty. But the reality is, this is all about getting the economy back open, right? And so it's okay if we lose people. It's okay if people who are immunocompromised, for whom maybe the vaccine doesn't work, it's okay for them to just like figure it out while we just open the doors and go outside with no mask and all the things. And so it's pretty disheartening to see how easily some of us, even like in my own community around like, oh, we have a certain set of values, but then when the rubber meets the road, we are down to do things that we know are going to actively harm the folks that we need to be centering in this moment. And I also know that, like, in this context where we're just so individual focused, it's like every person for themselves. And that is not the organizing that I'm a part of in my community. That's not how we get down, but crisis will send you there. When you get pushed to your very, very, very limit, it does bring forward the possibility that you're going to be like, okay, well, look, I got to do me. And if you see enough people doing that, you're going to do it too, because there's, how are you going to survive if everyone's like, fuck the collective, like, I got to do me. But this stuff is by design, you know, and that to me is what's really scary, is that it's the same cycle repeating itself. And we actually had a collective opportunity to do something different. And we did for a short amount of time. And then when someone said, okay, well, here's a pathway that will make it easier for you, but you got to say, fuck those other people, people said, sure. And so for our organization, because we are rooted in disability justice, people are like, oh, convenings and this, we are until further notice working virtually, because we know and understand that in our community, we have so many sick and disabled people, and we're not going to just keep it moving at their expense, at our expense. Like, it's just, that's not how we get down. That's not healing justice. And that actually does mean, you know, right now it's workable, but there's going to come a time probably in next year where we're not going to be able to participate fully in some of the things that we need to participate in because of ableism and capitalism. And sitting with that reality is hard. And this is like, you either practice your values or you do the thing that's easy. And for me, I'm like, you know, bringing it back around to the beginning of the conversation around queerness, like, it is not easy to be queer. It's not easy to be out. Like, nothing that I signed up for in this life has been easy. And so I'm willing to do the hard thing because it's the right thing. And I'm willing to do that with a real small group of people or alone, because for me, that's my integrity. And that's all that I have. And that's not to like judge some of the really hard choices that people are having to make. But I do feel like the rush to normal is very horrifying, because we know who's going to, it's not even get left behind. We know who's going to die as a result of that. We literally know. And I came into this work because I'm like, I don't want people to die unnecessarily. Like, a lot of the stuff is preventable. And I think it's becoming a more unpopular opinion to push back around that.
Yeah. I want to ask like one final thing in this vein, because I can't help but think of like specifically like queer, trans, BIPOC youth that are coming of age and growing up in this time, and that may not have the support system around them. And I'm just curious, like, how we can help them in this time of need, help increase mental health access and continue like work with this community mindset, like you're saying, especially in this time of crisis when it's so easy to go like, I'm feeling this way, so I just need to focus on me, which is important, but there's a lot more work to be done for the community and the collective.
That's a really great question. I think my first answer is the answer always, is to actually ask and listen to what young people need. I think that there's a way that younger folks, they have built so much community online. Actually, right? Like, I'm like, when I came out, the internet was just popping. It just started. I know I don't look that old, but I'm 41. And the internet was like, oh, wow. That was not a thing that I had access to until I was in my 20s. And so there is a way that, because of technology, and obviously not everyone has access to technology, but there is a way that young people have already been in a practice of interdependence and community care across time and space, because they grew up in a world where there was more access. I also think that because of some of the shifts and changes around being able to offer mental health supports virtually, you know, a lot of us are in conversation around like, we might always have a hybrid practice because this is actually more accessible for folks depending on their mental health conditions and or physical disabilities or sickness, right? Which is like, if I'm working with someone who has severe anxiety, who's physically disabled, and I'm like, the only way you can see me is if you come to my office, that's a problem. That's a barrier, right? So I think that practitioners really thinking through, like, it might actually make sense for the rest of our time to be in this hybrid space. I also think that, and this is one of the things that we think a lot about, is if you are bound to practitioners who are in your community only, and you're in a community where there aren't a lot of queer and trans people of color, let alone therapists who are queer and trans people of color, actually being able to see people virtually gives you more access. So now it's like, you can see someone who's in the state, right? I also know that there's folks who are hoping and organizing to really remove some of these barriers around being able to work with folks based on location, to actually like, what does it mean? Instead of me having to get licensed in every single state where I'm trying to work, can we have a national licensure? You know, we have to think through some of the consequences of that. But actually, like, for our people to have more access, we have to actually remove some of these borders and barriers, and to also listen. And sometimes people need someone to talk to. And sometimes people are like, I need money. You know, I need financial supports. I need to make sure I can keep my internet on so I can have access to these things. So I think we need to really listen. And I've been really proud of some of the organizations that I work with, that they've been like, okay, we're going to give direct cash aid to young people at this time, because that's what they need. We're not about to make them do a whole bunch of, like, here's a check. You do what you need to do with it. Right? Okay, you don't have a bank account. How do we figure out a way for you to get this money? It sounds basic, but like, the number of times I get invited to speak, how do you reach hard to reach populations? They are not hard to reach. You can't reach them because you're not a part of them. But also, they're not hard to reach because if you ask people what they need and you listen and you follow up, then we don't have these problems with like, oh, we don't know how to get to the people. It's like, you're not relevant to them. And if you want to be relevant, then you have to listen. And there are a lot of things that, you know, depending on if you're a nonprofit or not, that you can and can't do. But a lot of that stuff is made up. A lot of that stuff is not actually related to the law. It's related to certain kinds of practice and inflexibility. And so some of what we also are really clear about is like, because this was not, I didn't create an organization to just have an organization. This needs to be useful. And when InQtsin has served its purpose and we don't need it anymore, I hope that it sunsets. I hope that we get to a place in my lifetime where we don't need this, because that problem has been tended to enough that we don't have to have an organization that's just set up to make sure that queer and trans people of color get treated with dignity and respect when they go to therapy. Like, that should not be, I shouldn't have a job. I'm trying to work myself out of a job. But yeah, I really appreciate that question, because the young people have needed the same things even before COVID. It just is exacerbated now.
Yeah. And then just like one last thing that has been the theme for the season. What is bringing you joy and hope right now?
Okay, Lil Nas X for sure.
Yes.
Every day I wake up and I'm like, I want to be like Lil Nas X when I grow up. I feel like I'm not living my best life in terms of Black, queer, everything. Like, I just, I love him. He's amazing. And I love what he is agitating also inside of me. You know what I mean? I'm like, I love that. I'm like, oh my God, I'm uncomfortable by this. And I think it's great. It's like stirring something up that needs to be stirred up. So for sure, Lil Nas X. I mean, all of the like comedy that has come out of just like how ridiculous these times are. Like, I'm in a group chat where it's like, we're just sending memes to each other, because this is wild. These are some really, really wild times, and humor is like one of the best pieces of medicine. And I spend a lot of time in nature. You know, I spend a lot of time in nature, and I spend a lot of time connecting with people I care about in nature, because that's for me a really important resource. And, you know, there's just so many teachings in being able to be in alignment, especially with the land that I'm currently on, which is my home in Baltimore. So those are some things. I also have a puppy. So, you know, it stays live around here. She don't know that it's the apocalypse. She's just like, when are we going to go play? Like, I don't care.
I know, truly. All I know is that you're home every day, and that is all I need.
I know, exactly.
Yeah, no, I love all that. Yes, I mean, Lil Nas X. Yes. Oh my God. Just because it's going to be the last interview of the season. But just like, the reason I've done this is because, like I said, it's like so often, and as it should, our trauma gets more exposure than our joy, which I feel like can perpetuate this narrative, and especially to younger people, that like, it's going to be nothing but hard, which is true because of how the world still views queer people and so many minorities. But it's also so amazing when you find your community. It's so incredible. And I think that is a huge step when you find your community to helping your own self and your joy and working through experiences when you get to talk about like, oh, it's not just me. I'm not the only one that's gone through this. There are others like me. That's so incredibly healing. So yeah, I'm so, so grateful for you and everything that you're doing. And I'm so grateful for this conversation. I've learned so much and I'm just so excited to follow you and QTTCN. So just like truly thank you from the bottom of my heart for everything you're doing.
Thank you. This is such a great conversation and I love podcasts. I think that they're so important. There are podcasts that I listen to regularly and they are just as important as the rest of my healing practices. Like, you know, because there's something about the accessibility and being able to hear real-time story, right? That like really helps decrease our isolation. So just appreciate you for this platform and all the voices that you've had.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, if you want to follow Erica, he is on Instagram at ebmore1. You can go to his website, ericawoodland.com. All of this will be linked in the show notes below. We'll also link the National Queer and Trans Therapists of Color Network website. Erica, is there anything else you want to say before we sign off?
Just thank you. This has been great.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Queer Queries listeners, for tuning into this episode. And go have yourself a good day. All right. Bye-bye now. Hey, all. Thanks for tuning into this episode of Queer Queries. The show is produced by, yours truly, co-produced and edited by Addison McKissack. Theme song written by Matt Gregory, Colin Egan, and Mike Hubbard. Produced by Colin Egan and Mike Hubbard. Have an inquiry, topic suggestion, guest idea? Email askqueerqueries@gmail.com and I'll be sure to get back to you. Also, follow us on Instagram @queer.queries and be sure to like and subscribe and go tell the whole world about the Queer Queries podcast.